Welcome, everybody. If any of you do any level of renovations or have even thought about or getting into new builds, you need to learn and understand the permitting process. And it is a process. And that is exactly what we're going to be talking about in today's show. If this is your first time joining us, Tips from the Pros is a segment out of an investor's journey. In here, we bring on local experts to share what they're really, really good at and to share with you real life tactics and strategies on things that are working in today's market, not theories or things that worked for them 10 years ago. No, they're sharing what they're actually doing in today's market to help you understand the process and help you understand everything as it works today. So with that being said, I want to go ahead and introduce my guest today, and I want to tell you a little bit about him that's very impressive. So our guest today is Seth Teal with Somos Real Estate. Seth is a graduate of St. Louis University. He holds a bachelor's degree in criminal justice, a master's degree in urban affairs, as well as a certificate in economic development. He's a smart guy. He bought his first investment property in 2000 and has been full-time real estate investor since 2012. Over the last 10 years, Seth has worked on residential, commercial, and institutional development projects. Early in his career, he worked with a green home builder developing infill sites in the city of St. Louis. He has worked on the development of large corporate campuses across the United States and abroad. Seth is a LEED, L-E-E-D, accredited professional, and holds a building operator certificate. So he's definitely has no problem taking a lot of tests. Since arriving in Texas, Seth has begun his career as a realtor and full-time residential real estate investor. In the last 8 years, he has been party to more than 600 real estate transactions, accounting for more than 30 million real estate assets. Seth has completed more than 50 residential flip projects and specializes in historic renovations. In 2017, Seth started his boutique brokerage, Somos Real Estate, a full-service real estate and development firm serving the San Antonio Metro. Seth sits on the board of Zoning Board of Adjustment for the City of San Antonio and is an active within the local small business owners and entrepreneur community. And when he's not working with working on real estate, Seth is kayaking in Upper Guadalupe and sipping some really good bourbon. That's what I mostly know him for, is drinking bourbon. I didn't know he did real estate, so that's news to me. With that being said, Mr. Seth, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, man. Just happy to be here. Kind of a very hot topic right now that we'll be going over, because, you know, friends, clients, and everybody in between that we know have had issues with permits.
Yes, yes. And we actually have a comment right now. I don't know if you know this lady, Erica Torres, but she says, fantastic introduction. So proud to be on his team.
Thanks, Erica.
Yes. So, I mean, that's actually exactly what I always hear from people that know Seth and that know you and work with you, and why I like working and knowing you, and why, you know, anytime I've gotten anybody that wants to invest in real estate, because we don't find properties for people. We do our own investment, but I always send everybody to Seth. It's like, you want to buy investment properties, you want to do all that, go talk to Seth. And you've been a huge resource and help for me. You know, I mean, you know, I'm always hitting you up for it. You know, this person, that person, and you seem to have all the contacts, man. So great.
But if
great
I can help, I can. I will.
Yes, yes, yes. You're very, very good at what you do. So with that all being said, is there anything in the intro that maybe I missed or maybe you wanted to touch on?
No, I look really good on paper. I just look like a bum in person.
Don't we all, man? We can definitely make ourselves look good on paper. So to start off this interview, what is it that made you get started in real estate? So out of everything that you were doing, what was it that called you into real estate investing?
So my freshman year of college, I didn't adapt well to dorm life and started looking at properties in and around the university there in St. Louis. and ended up putting together and pitched a pro forma to my dad about how much money he would save getting me out of the dorms and not having to pay for my room and board if he'd co-sign on a loan for me. And so I ended up buying a duplex. He agreed. He co-signed a loan. He matched my down payment. And then the agreement was we would be partners on the profit. You know, my father was pretty nice. He only took a profit for the first 2 years of the ownership of the house, and then he turned it over to me. So that was great. But so I started out doing that, renting out the rooms of my, you know, my side of the duplex, and then renting out the other side, and slowly just kind of emerged to do that on multiple properties while I was going to school or working full time or both.
Wow. But why real estate? Out of everything else out there, why real estate? What called you to that?
I'm a very tactile and tangible person, so I like the idea of something being tied to a physical structure or something that, you know, an inanimate object, something that even if the everything, you know, you lose everything, there's a tangible object that you can reach out and say, I still own this. There's still intrinsic value to it. And I think that's what attracted me to real estate. Maybe it was just some ignorance on not understanding markets at the time or other investment vehicles. This just seems so tangible and easy to grasp the idea of. That's why I went forward with it.
That sounds exactly like John Barr. That's what he loves about real estate. He likes that the fact that you can just touch it. It's not going to go anywhere. It can't evaporate. You know, people need it. So it's good to know. It's good to hear that. So with that being said, why a brokerage? I mean, so many people get into real estate. Like, what made you go down the agent route and then not only do that, but then also become a broker and open up a brokerage?
Yep. So, I mean, when I relocated back to San Antonio, I had already quit the corporate world. I hadn't worked for 6 months. I had already started working on my license in Missouri and decided to go ahead and get it here in Texas. So I just treated it like a job. I ended up going to Save War for 7 weeks straight and knocked out my license really quickly. And then, you know, I figured a good way for me to network, relearn San Antonio and move forward was go with a high volume, you know, investment firm. And so I kind of hit the ground running pretty quickly there. And then ultimately, as I did more of what I wanted to do, the flips and stuff like that, I realized, man, sometimes you've got a lot of money out when you're doing the flips and you've got peaks and valleys. So, you know, you got to figure out a way to smooth out some of those valleys. And I thought a good way to do it would be to open a brokerage. You know, and the full service, both an investment, but in the retail side of things. And so, you know, we've been slowly flattening those curves a little bit, but it's just like any business. It's, you know, you're learning new stuff every day.
Yeah. Well, the reason I was mainly asking that was because you have a lot of people that start brokerages and they do it more because it's going to save them money. You know, it's going to be beneficial as far as their own properties go. But you're actually building a brokerage. You're actually performing the services of a brokerage. You have agents performing traditional listings and all of that. So that's what I found interesting is that it's a whole other business, which is why that it caught my attention. Because, like I said, most people do it to help save them some money and whatever it is that they're doing. But you decided to, you have your real estate and let me start a brokerage business now of doing listings and stuff like that.
Well, the real idea was that, you know, if I didn't want to necessarily diversify outside of real estate, but if I diversified what I did in real estate, hopefully that would keep me afloat. You know, when we have COVID-19 pandemic pop up or when you have a really slow year or, you know, heaven forbid, the housing market goes in the toilet again. You know, in the first round in 2011, 2012, I did real well when the market was bad, you know, so it makes it actually can be tougher when the market's good sometimes.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. That is something that we've realized because John Barr, my business partner, is, well, you know him, but as many of the listeners know, he got his license for the same reason that I told you, right? It's just a way to make extra cash. And it's actually saved our butts countless times being able to, you know, when the peaks and valleys, like you were saying, you know, just to have a listing here and a listing there. And we did little listings here and there. And Yeah, I mean, it just evens things out so much more. So it's a good strategy to have. So do you recommend people become agents as well if they're in the investment space?
So, I mean, for me, you know, coming from the corporate world, and you read off some of my acumen there, I've always been a big thing on like creating a level of professionalization. So for me, getting the license was holding me to a higher standard. Not necessarily that it's bad to not have a license, but for me, I wanted to know that, like, no matter what, there was a set of standards that I had to adhere to, and I move up from, not stay below. And so that was important to me, you know, and I don't like to call myself a realtor or a broker, you know, there is a negative connotation sometimes with that. And, you know, I don't think that our brokerage exudes that. But, you know, we're really here to help find solutions for people, whether that's on the investment side or whether that's helping them buy or sell a home.
Right. And I mean, that's really what it is with any business, is if you don't have the virtues of being a good company and always doing what's right and not what's easy, because that's something that I believe a lot of people get confused in this business, is they chase that easy money and you're not really building a business or doing what's right for your clients, for your investors, for a lot of the people. So,
yeah, well, I mean, and that's kind of a good segue into why it's so important to pull permits. You know, if you're not pulling permits, you're cutting corners, and that's not the easy money. That's the hard money.
So let's get into that. So why do you need to pull permits? What's your thought process of why you must be pulling permits?
I'll be brutally honest. The first property that I renovated when I moved here to San Antonio, I ended up getting sued by the buyer. They came back almost 2 years after they had purchased the property and said the foundation was moving and that we had never disclosed that there had been foundation work done. And while we had disclosed and I had proof of all that, there had been a mischecked box on the seller's disclosure. So that was their opening. Well, when we got further into the discovery, we found out that the licensed contractor I hired never pulled the permits he stated. And I mean, this has happened to so many people. Yeah. You know, it's embarrassing to say it's happened to me, but it did, and it's a learning experience. And so not only did I have to deal with the lawsuit, you know, I had to deal with, there's a level of professionalism that I'd like to exude. And I took somebody's word for it and didn't do my due diligence. You know, now we have a process, you know, my guys don't get paid their first draw until that permit's pulled. You know, I need to see that. They don't get a second draw until my rough-in's done. That sort of thing. It's a, you know, I've started to set standards so that we're adhering to the guidelines we need to.
And so you're pulling permits not because you necessarily have to, right? Because you do have to, but you're also pulling permits just to keep your contractors in check, to make sure everything's being done to code and stuff?
Well, that and there's a liability associated with everyone involved in the transaction, regardless of their level of involvement. Unfortunately, in the state of Texas, anyone can get sued at any time for anything. You know, in that lawsuit, they also sued their buyer's agent, who, you know, like that was just nuts to me. But anyway. No, obviously we do it because we're supposed to, but you can't manage what you don't measure. And so having a system to put in place, whether it's cattle prodded by the city government or whether it's just how you run your business, it's extremely important, because then you can set milestones, you can check things off, you don't get overextended. You know, I have gotten overextended with contractors before and ended up eating a lot of money. So this helps ensure that, you know, I've got levels of checks and balances for me and my contractors, what we're doing with the city and how we're funding all this, you know.
So before we get into the, because I'm very interested in the checks and balances that you have on all this process, but before we get into that, let's talk about renovations first, right? So you have a renovation. What is it that you need to prepare before you go pull a permit? I mean, how do you even know that you need to pull permits? What's that start look like for a lot of people that don't know?
Well, we always tell our clients, just assume you need to pull one. because that's a good place to be. I'd rather waste 20 minutes of my time and realize that I didn't need a permit than just go ahead and willy-nilly and have a stop work order from code compliance or the city or whatever. It's one of those things you got to do. And so ultimately, when most of our projects at least start with foundation, well, that can be an independent permit. And then after that, we'll pull a general permit. I'm a licensed contractor with the city of San Antonio. So I'll pull a general permit. And basically, I put a whole narrative together, a site plan and everything detailing, every little thing I want to do to the house. Now, depending upon what that is, it predicates whether you need to have further permits open or not. You could pull a general permit and do a cosmetic renovation and not have to pull, electrical or plumbing tradesman permits. A general contractor can do some of the light electrical, plumbing, HVAC work, stuff like that. So you can do it under just the general permit. Sometimes, of course, when you get to, bigger projects, you're definitely going to want to have the general and then what they call child permits, which is the individual trades pulling their permit underneath. And then, of course, that's all kind of shepherded by the general contractor. And then the trades, they kind of shepherd themselves.
Okay. And so are you relying on the contractors to know what permits they need to pull, or are you making?
So, for the most part, we're doing full gut renovations. So it's a guarantee that I need to have electrical permit, HVAC permit, plumbing permit, a gas permit, that sort of thing. So I'll pull a general full narrative of what's going on. And then the city will advise me. They even note it usually in the computer. You'll need to pull individual trades permits, things like that. If it's a more cosmetic rehab, we've done a few of those. I generally just pull a general permit so that even if I don't think I 100% need it, I'll pull the permit because if there's nothing that has a direct inspection, then you've pulled the permit, you've done your due diligence, you've paid your fee to the city, and that allows you to make sure you're minding your P's and Q's and doing everything right, and you don't get a stop work order from a nosy neighbor calling something in. Because you are in the right doesn't mean that you won't have someone stop by from the city. So, and then the burden of proof is on you. So it's just for us, first thing we do is go get that general permit or that foundation permit and then take it from there.
We actually have a comment from Naomi Vallejo Salas saying, "My goodness, I just learned something new about disclosing foundation work."
Yeah, it's extremely important. We, in that case, we had actually provided photographs and it was mentioned in the inspection, but neglected to or inadvertently checked a wrong box on a seller's disclosure. And that left me open to liability. And then obviously that discovery found some other issues that hadn't been addressed. So it was a big learning experience for me.
And the first, one of the first things I learned when I came to San Antonio is an investor told me, they're like, you have two types of homes, those that have foundation issues and those that are going to have foundation issues. So it's just something that you just got to mentalize yourself that, especially with foundation, you can have plumbing issues because of it. It causes so many other things that you really need to understand how to evaluate a house, especially when they have foundation issues.
Definitely.
So a question that I've heard a lot is, you bought a house as an investor, right? You own it. Can you pull a permit as the homeowner, or do you need to be licensed contractor to do so?
So you used to be able to pull the permit as the homeowner. So if it's your homestead, you still have that right. If you own it in your personal name, you might be able to get by with it. But realistically, the city, if it's a second home or an investment property and it's not your homestead, they want you to hire a contractor that's licensed with the city to pull that permit. So that was part of the reason I ended up getting my contractor's license. I'm what they call a paper contractor. I've got all my credentials. I know how to run the work, but usually I'm more of a site superintendent or a project manager. And then I've got a general contractor that works underneath me, and they're beholden to me and getting all the trades and everything done right that way. But ultimately, it makes for me only to have one person to yell at. they can yell at all the subs.
And do you recommend, your personal, of course, opinion on this, do you recommend people become their own general contractor, get that license? to protect themselves.
It depends on what they want to do with it. So, you know, for me, I don't do contracting for other people. So it's just strictly for my business or any partnership that I'm involved in. And if you're not going to be doing, you know, using the permit or pulling permits yourself several times a year, it's not worth the $1 million liability policy that you have to carry, you know, for it. You know, that costs around anywhere from $1,000 to $1,500 a year, depending upon whether you're doing new construction or not. And so, I mean, that's something that affects your bottom line. If you're not going to use it, there's no reason to get that. It would probably save you money to just use a general contractor that's licensed.
Perfect. So let's talk about that now. Let's talk about the process that you go through. So you want to make sure your contractors are licensed, they're pulling permits. How do you verify all this, that they're not using somebody else's license to pull permits, or, you know, because...
That's a common place, especially with the trades, that, you know, they've got their journeyman status, but they're not a master tech, but they've gone out on their own and they've got a master tech that'll pull permits for them. We've ran into that a bunch. I don't like operating like that, because at any time that master tech and that journeyman can get into it with one another, and all of a sudden you're stuck with open permits and nothing that can be done. But what I do is, you know, first thing I ask for is license numbers. You can verify any of the trades online with their respective trade, not the trade unions, but the entities that govern that through the state. That's all, you know, public record. And then, of course, the city of San Antonio does have a database of all the licensed contractors and whether they're active or inactive. And you can search that on their website as well. We also ask for a copy of insurance. As silly as that sounds, you know, let's say you're having a roof redone and, you know, they've got everything off and they've got the underlayment paper down, and there's a terrible storm that comes through and they didn't tarp it, you know, and then all of a sudden you've got water infiltration into the home, potential mold issues, things like that. Well, sure, maybe your insurance policy will cover it, but ultimately it's not your fault. You know, it was the fault of the contractor, and realistically you should go after their insurance in that case. But yeah, so we try to verify insurance as well. And then, you know, ultimately everyone says they can pull a permit or they will pull a permit, and they don't get a dollar out, not an initial draw, not a material draw, nothing from us until that permit's pulled and I can look it up online and see that permit number. You know, and once that happens, you know, then we're better, but they don't get another set of money either until we've got that rough end done. So, you know, we kind of try to step it. And even when we go all the way through and you get the final pass, that doesn't mean the permit's closed out.
Right.
Let's say there was a couple times during the process where there was a partial pass or a fail. Well, the city automatically charges the total account, you know, $45 to $50 to come back out. Well, although that will be associated with, say, either the general permit or the child permit, you cannot close out that permit until those fees are paid. So I usually do a holdback of $500 no matter what. And because oftentimes it's tough to get your trades, even if you work with them and have a great relationship, it's tough to get them to go in and pay the city that $50 fee that they incurred for a failure on one of the inspections.
Right. And I mean, it's just that, right? Like, it's not, we tell a lot of our contractors, it's not a trust thing. It's not that we don't like you. It's just, it's a check and balance thing. We want to make sure that, you know, these things are being done, and we got to protect ourselves at the end of the day.
Right. And I mean, and sure, there's probably a few contractors here or there that I work with, but maybe I'm a little more lackadaisical with. Usually they're personal friends, you know, things like that, where they get a little more leeway. But ultimately, you know, I like to keep things as, you know, as business related as possible and have it formal, so that even if we are friends, when we're doing business, we're doing business. And then when we're outside of that purview, you know, let's be friends and not talk business.
You know? Exactly. Yeah, those lines of separation are so crucial in working relationships. So now you pull in your permits, you go to the city, you make sure you're getting all the permits, your contractor, you're verifying they got all the permits. Now, an issue for us has been dealing with the inspectors. So you get an inspector that comes and they tell you one thing, then you get another inspector and they're like, no, that's not it, it's this. And it's that kind of flip-flop kind of thing that you have to deal with. Is there a way that you have maybe to mitigate that a little bit, or is just part of the trade?
So, but I mean, it's a deficiency with the city's inspection process right now. You know, they've had a lot of turnover. The city's had some rapid growth. So you get turnover plus new hires. And so sometimes those new hires get assigned something that you've already had an inspector for. And, you know, they might be trying to make a name for themselves or be a stickler or, you know, that sort of thing. And so it does get confusing. You know, I've had something where we got a partial pass. They came back out to give us the final pass. And it was a different inspector, and he goes, oh, I need, you know, X amount of plugs here, here, and here. And although I verified, you know, with the code, we had met code, we're at his discretion to get that, you know, that inspection passed. So ultimately, you know, within 24 hours, I had four new outlets installed, even though they're unnecessary. But it's what we needed to go ahead and get that passed. One thing that we have found that kind of helps is if you're pulling a lot of permits and you're meeting with a lot of inspectors, and they tend to know who you are. They either know that you're doing good work that's above board or that you're just eking by. And so after you can establish some rapport with them, you know, you'll typically have their cell phone number and stuff, and you'll see when you pull your permit who the inspector is assigned to it, and you can request them personally to stay with it. It's not always their choice, but that may help. So there's a couple inspectors that, I mean, they're sticklers, but I like working with them because it's consistent. And that's been the biggest issue we've seen is consistency of application of the codes. You know, everybody's got a slightly varied interpretation of it. And to me, they're spelled out pretty black and white.
I completely agree. To me, there's no interpretation of it, but they seem to still have one. I mean, my biggest pet peeve has been where we do, it's happened more with electrical. Is we do the rough-in inspection, everything's great, everything is good. And then when we do the final inspection, they're like, oh, you're missing a plug here and a plug there. I'm like, dude, it's everything is sheetrock. Like, yeah. You came to do the initial walkthrough. What happened?
Electrical has been the big one for us every single time. It is that, especially when there's different inspectors coming out. They, you know, one wants it, you know, there's not an 8-foot span, so you don't need a outlet. And they're saying, well, it's over 5, so you do. It's they're rounding up.
Yeah.
And I get it to some degree. I just wish it was applied consistently.
And that's the same thing that we talk with John all the time is that, you know, I don't care what the code is. I'm not trying to, you know, bypass the code. It's just keep to it. You know, if this is what the code is, that's exactly what we're doing. But now you're forcing me to go back and cut holes in the sheetrock, run new cables where there's insulation. And like, you know, it's a pain in the ass. And then the contractors don't like it.
Well, and even if your electrician contractor, even if they say, you know what, I'll do this for cost or I'll do it for free, you still have the labor of patching that wall, painting it, making it look just like it did when there wasn't a hole in it, you know? And that's just, that nickel and dimes you on, and it takes time, and it's annoying.
Yeah, oh, precisely. It definitely takes time. And it's like I always say, it's not the cost of the $50 for a reinspection or anything. It's the fact that now I got to go ahead and do that whole process, extra days of getting that done, cost of my money and holding. And it's like, guys, it costs a lot more than $50 to get this done.
Yeah, exactly.
So I wanted to get your opinion now because inspections are a big thing and you deal a lot with historic homes in the historic districts and everything, mm-hmm. which have been booming in the past, you know, 5 years or so. It's been ridiculous. And you have a lot of novice investors that know nothing about not just investing, but about real estate, period, getting in there and doing just, you know, not hiring the right contractors, cutting corners, not pulling permits. How do you see that, maybe as an investor, as a realtor's point of view, how do you see that affecting the market prices and all of that?
Well, so, it's tough and twofold. One, in the sense that sometimes if these novice investors are going into, say, a historic district, they're not fully aware of all the requirements to meet everything. You know, so even if they do go through the HDRC process and they get a certificate of appropriate approved, you know, a lot of times people think that's where it stops. Ultimately, you've got to adhere to the guidelines of you know, what the certificate of appropriateness and what was approved by HDRC in the Office of Historic Preservation. And so a lot of times they go through that process and then don't adhere to it. And then all of a sudden they're 75%, 90%, 100% into the project. And then OHP comes out to the property and goes, oh, these aren't the windows you spec'd or that we approved, and, you know, and they're already $10,000 into windows, and they're going, now you got to take them out and put in another, you know, $10,000 worth of wood windows or whatever was specified. And over the last few years, the Office of Historic Preservation they've gained some teeth. You know, they've been able to get greater levels of enforcement, even on a new construction we're doing in Dignity Hill. You know, it's new construction. We're still beholden to wood windows, making sure that the windows have the right depth, look the right way from the street. We had guidelines as to how far apart our standing seam metal roof seams could be, types of siding. So there's a bunch that goes into it, the actual setback. And, you know, for the first time ever, we had to do a new construction Office of Historic Preservation setback inspection. They just started them in December. So that was new to us. It wasn't a big deal. We were all in the right, but it was just news to us, yep. You know, and the next thing I know, we're out there with an inspector. I'm like, I've never had to do this before. But the second part of your question is the big thing that I'm seeing is, let's look at Denver Heights per se, or Dignity Hill. That 78202 and 78210 zip codes have the largest backlog of inventory right now. And what you're seeing on that is you're seeing really high level of professional work and a really low level of professional work, and they're priced at the same price. And so that's what's causing this backlog. I mean, some of these properties have been sitting, you know, for months, and it's not that they're in bad areas. It's not that they're, a bad house. It's that the level of craftsmanship or what needed to be done to do it properly was not adhered to because somebody was chasing the quick money, you know, and oftentimes you see them with open permits and all that stuff. And, you know, we advise our clients, it doesn't scare me if the permit's open. I just need to know why and what we need to do to get it closed out. You know, if I'm the buyer, my client's the buyer.
Right. So now how do you feel that affects us as investors, right? Because if you have, the way we look at it is, if you have all these, the terrible ones, right? The terrible deals, the ones that, you know, they still have foundation issues, crooked walls, all of that. And they start dropping the price, because as far as an appraisal goes, you know, they still look at the pictures and they look at, you know, it's apples to apples. But it really wasn't. Like, that sold for $30,000 less because it was garbage, right?
Right.
So, like, how are you seeing, has that been affecting you or your investors in any way?
So I'm pretty picky with who I work with client-wise. So most of the people that I do work with put out a pretty solid level of product. If I am working with somebody and I think the product is maybe less than, you know, I'm upfront with them about it. You know, I said, look, man, I understand you're on a budget here, but you know, there's some stuff that maybe even just some paint touch-ups that you need to go through, caulking and things like that that have been ignored, that will just help everything show better, solidify it, make it look better. And so, you know, we see that on our end with our clients and whatnot. But ultimately, even if I typically don't like to list a bad rehab, you know, even if it's not my project, to me, it reflects on me.
Right. And when other investors are listing those bad rehabs, I mean, the reason I'm asking this is we had this situation, you know, we did that renovation in Denver Heights. And when we wanted to go ahead and list, we ran the comps and we saw that there were houses selling that would have been comparables to ours for $290,000. And we wanted to target like $330,000, $340,000. So we're like, oh shit, what are we gonna do? Right? Like, that's a huge price difference. And we know appraisers, they're gonna look at that $290,000 because it is a comparable.
Right.
But when we went to walk these houses, we're like, well, that makes sense. Why? Like, it's garbage. Like, I mean, they have so many issues, so many problems. So when we went ahead and listed, we listed for the $350,000 and they actually comped it to Dignity, which helped us. And the quality of work that we did and everything, it really helped us get that value. But I've seen it where even though you do quality work, those low prices are still bringing you down, you know?
Yeah, unfortunately, we're seeing that. And you know, the valuation is only as good as the appraiser. So, you know, whether I know or you know personally that valuation was up at 350, some appraisers don't walk their comps. You know, they might drive past them, but they're relying on the photos off the MLS. And I get that it's a little bit extra level of work. I know a couple of appraisers that they're like, no, I will even take my own photos of the comps I walk. But some, you know, it's like, did you just do this from home? Did you even walk the property? And so for me, what we try to do to keep that evaluation up, in fact, I was doing one this morning, is, you know, we send over as much information to the appraiser as we can. A lot of times I'll even meet them at the property for the appraisal with the folder. And I've got a copy of the contract and addenda. I typically have printed out a sheet of all the renovation items that have done and an associated total cost. And then I print out my own comps. And so far that has worked pretty well for us. I think I've had to do 7 rebuttals in the last 2 years. And every single one of them but one made full value after my rebuttal, and the one that didn't still came close. Right. So,
right. Wow, that's actually a really good tip. Just to be able to meet your appraiser, do the work for them in a way, just to make sure that, you know, if they happen to be lazy, at least you're providing them with some information.
Yeah, well, not only that, it's, you know, they're professionals as well. And so when you show up and you're providing them additional information, they realize that you're into this. You're doing this. You have some heart behind it. And mentally, they start seeing that value more so because you put in the extra effort. Whereas if it's just a vacant property or whatnot, you know, they're in and out and they see what they see, and then it's a crapshoot.
Yeah, for sure. So now let me ask you, with this, we'll stick on just one more thing with the rehabs and then we'll move into new builds. I'm curious on that. Okay. But with the renovations and all of this, how do you stay up on the code changes and everything like that? Because, I mean, I meet contractors so many times that are always surprised by the codes, right? It's like, that wasn't the code. That's never been the code. And, I mean, yes, it's easier for us or for you when you're doing a lot of renovations back to back because you kind of see them throughout the projects. But for somebody that's kind of getting started or maybe he's done a few here and there, like, how do you stay up on the code changes and stuff like that?
So the city has a whole process for approval of the new codes. You know, they typically will approve the most up-to-date that they can of the International Building Code. So, like, we're 2018 right now of that code. You know, we knew... They advised that we're moving towards this. We knew the date that it was going to go into effect, and then there was a drop dead date that all things had to meet the new code. The important thing is to make sure that especially your tradesmen are up on the new codes. Typically, they have a continuing education where they're going to learn whatever the updates are from 2015 to 2018 or possibly 2020. We may adopt next year. You know, there's usually a year lag. Just we're a big city. We're not nimble enough to move with every update of the code. It's making sure. And if your contractors are staying licensed and keeping up with their CE, they should know. General contractors, on the other hand, it's a lot of that. You know, they need to be doing their own research. And unfortunately, it's terribly tedious. I'm looking up codes to work with my general contractors to make sure, you know, they're telling me one thing and I know it to be another or vice versa, but we've got to verify that somehow so that we're not having to make an adjustment or have a change order in the middle of the process. So just last week on new construction, you know, my general was saying, hey, I want 36 inches for this toilet. And I said, well, 30 inches of space from side to side total is all that's required for the code. And he pushed back on it. And I was like, no, we have this design specifically this way. I know that it meets code. I shoot him a diagram of the code with all the clearances needed. And he's like, okay, fine. He's like, I think it was because the plumber didn't want to run the drain in that wall. It's a brand new construction. Wow. Yeah. Well,
and that's really why I was asking the question, because that's something that I want to really get across and stress to people, is that just don't rely on other people telling you what is. Like, try to do the research. Be a real investor by understanding the process yourself. Don't just hope that somebody's telling you the truth, because, I mean, most of the time they are not.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of times it's flying blind. Every time I've learned a lesson, you know, I've had to respond to that, or even if I've been proactive, it's all a new process. And every time there's a new process of any kind, there's some apprehension. You know, you could be scared to do it. I'm considering doing a rezone on something which I haven't had to do before. You know, I've been through the process with clients, but I haven't had to do it personally. And so now I'm like, well, you know, how much is this going to cost me? How long is this going to take? What's it going to need? And it's just, all right, I'm doing all my due diligence, talking to people that have gone through it before and making sure, all right, is this a viable option, you know?
Yeah. Well, we actually have a comment from some stranger. I don't think either one of us knows. It's Felix Seager. He said 2021 code is coming. So that's something to look forward to.
Well, And like I said with the contractors, Felix is a designer, architect that you and I believe we both use. Mm-hmm. Those guys, them and the engineers, stay up on the code better than anybody.
Yes.
I mean, Felix can recite, you know, to the decimal point codes sometimes, and that's great because that helps out tremendously with either combating a contractor or just having it for your own personal knowledge. Plus, it makes the process easier.
So I think kind of touching on that a little bit, I think you would agree that it is worth, I understand that in the project, everything is, you know, the bottom line, you try to work the expenses and everything. But with things like this, it's always better to hire somebody that knows their shit, even though they may be more expensive than you want, because it's going to cost you 2 to 3 times more if you hire somebody that's cheaper and they don't know what the hell they're doing.
100%. When I first started doing house renovations, I did a lot of the work myself. And I've never been good at doing much other than some carpentry. And so, you know, what would take me 6 months probably could have been done in 30 days if I had just hired the right person. But, you know, I was on a wing and a prayer and no money at all and thought I was saving money, and ultimately it wasn't. And it's tough to relinquish the reins on that and put your trust in somebody else. So, you know, I can understand apprehension about that as well.
Yeah, so we actually have a question from Greg Martinez. He's asking, where can you find the latest codes? Is there access online?
So there is. You can need, so the city will have their ordinances all listed online. And then when you want to dive further into the actual codes, you can either look up whatever the current is here, which I believe is the 2018 building code. That you can search just generally online, or you can search it through the city's website. Sometimes the city website is pretty cumbersome to try to move through. And typically that's when I either pick up the phone or send an email to planning, and I'll ask for a link. You know, I'll say, hey, you know, can you send me a link to these codes? I mean, there's sites that you can subscribe to so you get the most up-to-date codes and it sends you emails and everything. But most of this stuff, if not all of it, is public record. So it may take you just a little effort to do a search. And then I always just save them, you know, on my taskbar, you know, as that way, if I need to quick reference it, you know, I can at least pull up, search, and then if I've got an idea, I can verify, you know, at a later time kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I have a whole tab on my website, on my webpage that has all the codes, everything, so I could just zoom right to it. But Felix is helping out. He says, Greg, International Code Council has codes available online. And Felix was also nice enough to share a link to it. So for those of you listening, check the comments. And if you're listening on the podcast, I'm going to link it below on the show notes so you can check out that link. So thanks, Felix. You're a freaking superstar. all right. So getting into new builds, what is the biggest difference that you see when you're pulling permits and stuff like that for renovation versus a new construction? Like, how's this process change?
On the renovation process, you know, I can typically pull everything together. I'll usually get a site plan and a floor plan done, you know, and then I take everything in and fill it out, or at least pre-COVID, that's what you do. You take it in, you fill out the application, you provide your information, you give it to them, and then you meet with somebody, and, you know, you could be in and out in 15 to 20 minutes, on, you know, if it's not too busy. that was great. Unfortunately, now the new process, you know, for the for any permitting is you've got to submit it, and there's, you know, at least on what used to take 15, 20 minutes, there's a, you know, 24, 48, or 72 hour turnaround time. You go and get it picked up, or they make comment on it, and then you've got to adjust. It's not terribly cumbersome, you know, but it was a lot cooler when you could just go in and yeah. get it done. Now on the new construction, there's a lot of crossing your T's and dotting your lowercase J's that you got to make sure are done, you know. So working with somebody like Felix, who I've gone through a few new construction projects with, and some associated engineers, you know, these are folks that are submitting regularly. So they know the little quirks from each individual reviewer, and they try to go ahead and call out things that they know is going to be a comment or an issue. You know, so on a new construction, if you've got all your ducks in a row and you think everything's perfect, you're still probably looking at a 30-day turnaround on your permit. We've taken as long as 3 months where we had some issues that weren't addressed by our original engineer and had to hire a second engineer to come in and basically answer the questions that the city was asking and do a couple updated drawings. So the process for the new construction, it's prescriptive but not iterative. And so to that end, you think you've hit everything, and then the reviewer comes back again, their level of interpretation, they've got questions that need to be answered, or they need to see something detailed or illustrated. And that's when you go back to your designers and you say, hey, look, this is what I need help with, this, this, and this. And this is one of those cases where, you know, hiring somebody and paying a little extra goes a long way, because all of a sudden you think you've got everything right, and then you're standing there working with the city and going, I'm never going to get this project approved at all, you know, and you feel perplexed. You know, I've been doing construction off and on for 15 years. And I on our first new construction, I was like, what the hell am I doing? I have no idea how to get through this permit process. It seems so simple, you know?
Oh, I mean, well, you've heard our dilemma with the Dignuity project that we're doing. And I mean, it pretty much took over a year before we can break ground with all the shit, because we were doing rezoning. We were doing, you know, I mean, mostly it's been dealing with the pain in the ass neighbor that we have, that he's raising all kinds of hell and the city folds every time he talks.
Which is unfortunate.
Very, very unfortunate. But what's great is actually a lot of the neighborhood has been coming to our defense, because they realize that all we do is comply with what they say, and he still tries to throw us under the bus, right? So yep. The neighborhood has been helping. But going back to it, it is so crucial, because, I mean, we didn't hire the best engineer. I mean, because, you know, we relied on our contractor that at the time, you know, he was saying that he knew all this inside and out and whatever, and we realized he didn't know shit. We didn't know anything. So, I mean, it was a huge learning process of figuring this whole thing out. And that's why, like I'm saying, like, you hire somebody, yeah, they may cost more, but the time you're going to save and the headaches, my God.
Well, and ultimately, you're paying for their knowledge.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not just a deliverable, the plans or the piece of paper or the engineer's letter. You're paying for the schooling, the knowledge, you know, them as a resource above and beyond just the deliverable.
Yeah.
And so sometimes that's really tough to explain. It's been tough to explain to partners, you know, that all they're seeing is bottom line. And I'm saying $500 here is going to save us $1,500 down the line or more.
Or more, yes. Yes, because if you get the delays like that we got, I mean, we've lost potential profit and everything. Obviously, it's still a great deal. We're still okay. But we've lost over $15,000 of potential profit just on delays. Like, it's insane.
Yeah.
It's insane what you lose. So kind of now, how are the fees compare? Because new builds, you know, you're pulling everything. So you get to get the permits to even begin.
It's not terrible. You know, you have a review fee, and then there's the actual permit fee. So the review fee, I think, is around $400 or something like that. And then your permit fee is based on square footage and project cost and things of that nature. You know, and then they verify what you're telling them it's going to cost, essentially. And then sometimes they'll apply their own valuation to it if you're way off. But I mean, so the last two new builds we did, one was 2,400 square feet and one was 1,800 plus, you know, and I think we came in right around $1,100 or $1,200 for a permit, you know. So it's not astronomical. It's not, you know, even a full percentage point of most projects. So, you know, and ultimately, like, we're paying for a service. You know, I like that the city's trying to hold things to a certain level of professionalism, from the sense that if you drive around and you see what's been done preceding them being strong about this, there are plenty of potential hazards, dangerous homes, dangerous additions, things of that nature. And while we got used to that and it not being enforced, you know, I think ultimately this is a move in the right direction with the city.
I completely agree. I mean, seeing all the work that's been done, especially in the historic districts where you have bigger builders that have gotten away with things and they've built pretty much like KB homes in Dignuity. And it's like, damn, like you're messing up the whole vibe of the neighborhood just because you're able to get away with it.
Yeah, and I mean, fortunately, it has become a little bit tougher, especially in the historic districts. But, you know, ultimately, I don't think historic preservation should be stopping development. I think people should be working on both sides to create good development. And I think that's ultimately what the city wants, developers want, and what the citizens want. It's just making, you know, you've got to, there's intrinsic value to things that isn't just in the bottom line. And sometimes you've got to look beyond that. And I think that's what helps sell properties. Cookie cutter versus actually put some thought into it.
Yes.
And that could be the difference in $50,000 in price.
And that kind of hits always on the point that I always say, you know, when contractors try to become investors, and I'm like, contractors know how to do the job, but they don't know what job needs to be done. That's more comes from the investor. The investor knows what job needs to be done that's going to sell better, right? Just because you can do a house, build a house for cheap, doesn't mean that you should, because it may not sell at all for those numbers. So knowing what needs to be done is just as important. Now, zoning. What are your thoughts, you know, when it comes to zoning and what to be careful for? What are some of the pitfalls on zoning?
Yeah, so I'm not a big fan of blanket zoning and at all. You know, my background in urban planning and urban affairs, you know, it was a lot of code development, overlay district development and stuff when I was in grad school. It's really, really difficult for you to take any swath of land, whether it's in the you know, urban core, you know, or even some of those entering suburbs, and just blanket rezone or zone all one thing. You know, and the city has a process for circumnavigating that, either through a non-conforming use, a rezone, or in some cases a variance, depending upon what it is you're wanting to do. However, none of those avenues are easy, you know, and the onus falls on the owner or the investor, the developer, and it's also subject to approval by a city, by city council if it's a rezone, neighborhood associations weigh big time, neighbors in general weigh big time. If you have a voice to be heard, it will be heard here in San Antonio. It's a double-edged sword. On some levels, it's amazing how much power the citizens have. On the other levels, it's annoying as hell. So. Yes. You know, and so, I mean, that's why it's so important to look at it first before you even buy the project. You know, you want to be looking at, all right, what is my use versus what is it zoned? What we see big time is with our investors that want to buy multifamily properties. So let's say it's set up as a duplex right now, but it's zoned single family. So those can present issues, even if the house was built. Let's say it was built in 1940 as a duplex, it's operated as a duplex its entire life, but at some point the city decided to blanket rezone the area, and that house went from RM6 to R6. You know, and then the city goes, well, you're a non-conforming use. Cool, we've got this process for you. You can get a non-conforming use, but you have to prove that since it was rezoned, it is still operated as a duplex you can't have more than 1 year of vacancy from that use. They want things like to provide leases, proof of land use, stuff like that. I mean, we had to do one for one of my clients, a threeplex in Government Hill, and he ended up finding leases back to the 90s. And they had blanket rezoned him, you know, in like 2011 from MF33 to R6. So it was, I mean, so it's not an easy process. It's frustrating when I can look at a house that's in a residential neighborhood and it has a commercial zoning and the city says, well, it's commercial. I'm like, look at the end use. Look at the use class on the Bexar County Appraisal District. Everyone knows this was a house. It was built as a house. And now you've got to go through a rezone process if you don't want to go through the non-conforming use process every year. So, I mean, that could be a real pain. It can also keep you from being able to refinance out if you're not zoned properly. It can also keep you from getting a loan up front if it's not zoned properly. So, I mean, those are major issues that can stop or halt transactions and ultimately cost you money.
Yeah, 100%. So is there a process for, because, I mean, all of this is research that you would want to do before you buy the property, right? So, I mean, what's the best way? Like, how do you even know that that's happening? Like you said, the house was built as a house, looks like a house, it's been lived in as a house, but it wasn't zoned.
So in our due diligence, you know, one of the first things we do, the city has a one-stop map on their website that you can look up the zoning of any parcel. You type in the address and it will show you what the zoning is. You can click on it, it's the GIS map. It'll give you pedigree information about the zoning code, any overlay districts, things like that. So then we look at that, okay, is it zoned the way we'd like it to be zoned? If not, you know, am I buying it at a price where I can incur a rezone or going through the process of the non-conforming use? You know, and I look at it that way. You, again, this is all public information. That also doesn't mean that it's easy to find. You know, a lot of this information is out there, but you're looking for a needle in a haystack to find the proper information. I make no bones. I'll reach out to the city. I'll shoot emails. I'll leave voice messages. Usually somebody gets back to me within a few days. And once you can get, again, establish a rapport with certain people, they tend to start answering your calls or your emails because they know you want a specific question answered. You're not going to take up a bunch of their time and you appreciate what they're doing. So, you know, we reach out to the city whenever we need to.
And to that point, and that's a very good point to make, is that when the city and the inspectors and everybody know that you're just not busting their balls, that you're actually doing this and you're trying to do it the right way, they do take the time to talk to you. They do prefer to talk to you and they help you out. They tend to ignore the people that are just more of a pain in the ass and not really going anywhere.
Yep. Well, and to that end, you know, even if you get a co-compliance red tag for something, you know, let's say it's not a stop work order, but maybe there's too much trash on your job site or you need to mow the grass. I pick up the phone every time I get one of those and I call the co-compliance officer and say, hey, look, my property, this will be taken care of in 48 hours. I'll send you the follow-up letter with everything. Right. This is my number. If you need anything, just give me a call directly. And that has worked wonders because you own vacant property. Sometimes you get squatters. Sometimes you don't get down there enough to see that the grass is 10 feet tall. You know, it's not that I'm not trying to comply. It's that, you know, I'm busy enough. Sometimes I don't get by a property. And so I'll make sure it's taken care of as soon as possible. When you work with the co-compliance officers like that, they'll give you a heads up. Hey, I'm not going to give you a red tag, but your grass is looking a little low. I'll get a text every now and again. And I'm saying, okay, perfect. It'll be taken care of in 48 hours.
For sure. That is so valuable. So kind of going back on the zoning thing, what are your thoughts? In Austin, they do this a lot. And San Antonio wants to have a more vibrant downtown. I mean, not right now during COVID, but eventually, if everything ever opens up again in this world, they want to have a more 24/7 lifestyle is what they called it, right? Which requires more density. So in Austin, for more density, they do condo regimes for instead of doing zoning and subdividing lots and everything. Like, do you have any thoughts or anything on condo regimes?
Well, so it Texas has a lot of weird, archaic laws. And people don't like change here very much. So oftentimes, instead of changing what's existing, people find a loophole or a workaround. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what the land condo is. It's a workaround so that you don't have to jump completely through a rezone or have to do a full overlay district. Basically, like everything in Texas, they put the onus on you. You take care of it, you pay for everything, and they go, okay, I think we'll approve it. You know, or they tell you, no, you know, take a hike, or they say, okay, we'll approve it, but you got to change this, this, and this. Mm-hmm. So I like the idea of the land condo, but I think it's unnecessary. I think if we were a little open to change or creating overlay districts that weren't so rigid, that actually are somewhat fluid with what our city actually needs, I think that we could create 24/7 lifestyles, entertainment districts, mixes of uses, mixes of income, all of that can happen. And that's what makes a vibrant city. You know, make it walkable, make it gorgeous, make it desirable. And you'll see it. I'm starting to see some of that along the Broadway corridor.
Yes.
And I would really love to see a median. And I know people will go, Zari, so much traffic. If you slow down traffic and you use stoplights properly and have proper crosswalks, you'll actually be able to move through that section of Lower Broadway much more efficiently. And it allows for people to move across both sides, you know, to and from the Pearl and Government Hill and things like that safely.
Right.
You know, that's one of my biggest concerns, whether it's on Broadway or North St. Mary's or in Southtown. You know, we don't even have, adequate pedestrian islands and crosswalks as far as I'm concerned. And it's just a matter of time before somebody gets hit and killed.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I mean, I've lived down Broadway since I moved to San Antonio. And as traffic has increased, I believe like the way they use traffic lights and everything, it has not been updated at all. And some of the way the traffic lights work, I'm like, oh, come on. I was like, at least have a sensor or something on this.
Yeah. Well, yeah, at least in the urban core, I don't think there's any lights on sensors.
No.
So, I mean, it's nuts. And let's say the world does open back up. That's why we can't make our EPA attainment levels. You've got people sitting idly with no traffic going either way, sitting for 5 minutes at a light in your urban core. You know, increasing the heat island effect, bunch of other, you know, secondary and tertiary issues that are caused as a result of us having, you know, just old infrastructure.
Yeah, for sure. So last question about all this is, how do you deal with neighbors? So let's say, you know, you're building in Dignuity, which is usually the biggest issue because the neighbors there have been overlooked for many years by developers, and developers have kind of ran through and done whatever they want, and they feel ignored by the city, they feel ignored by their own HOA. So what we've experienced is that they decided to take it out on us and use us as their reason, you know, as a proof to the negligence that they've been going through. So what is something more preemptive that maybe an investor that's getting into these areas can do to work with the neighbors to make sure they avoid these problems moving forward?
Yeah, so I mean, usually our first call is to the neighborhood association if there is one, you know, because that's at least usually a formal board of some sort, mm-hmm. you know, and if we need to meet with them or whatnot, you know, we try to get them to sign off on it. It doesn't always necessarily mean an endorsement, but it means, hey, you guys are not going to put up a fight necessarily against this. Now, individuals, on the other hand, is a different story. You know, you can have one person. We've had people that live next door and say, oh, we don't mind the work. We're happy to see the house renovated. On the other side, you know, we've seen people that go, you're going to raise my property values. I hate you. You know, and to me, you know, the big taboo word is gentrification. You know, everyone sees that as a negative context, and there are negatives to gentrification, but there are also positives associated with it. And when somebody says to me, you're raising my tax value on my property, I say, why aren't we fighting this archaic tax structure that displaces legacy homeowners within the neighborhood? You know, the homestead and the 65 plus and the disabled veteran, those are all great programs for tax abatement, but it's not enough. If we tie everything to the property, somebody who might have paid off their property in 1960 may be getting priced out in 2020 because those property values have gone so high. And that to me should never happen. You know, so there are some programs and things for some of that relief, but ultimately, you know, it would take a change in the Texas charter to alleviate the property tax burden that what I see creates some of the big gentrification issues.
Yeah, and I agree 1,000%. I think what happens, and I've seen it, not just in the historic districts, but even there's neighborhoods over here by the airport that we've renovated houses, and older people that lived there their whole lives own the house free and clear. Now the houses are selling for $220,000, so they can't even afford to pay their taxes because they're on fixed income. And it's like, right, we own it free and clear, but we can't afford the damn taxes on this house. And it's like, yeah, there should be something against that, but there isn't. And we're the ones that take the hit for it. And it's like, I try to tell our neighbors, like, hey, if the city didn't want us here, we wouldn't be here. Like, I'm not here to push you out. Like, that's not my goal.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's just, you have really, this house is falling apart. There's, you know, there's people breaking in. It's a hazard and everything. We're trying to make it look nicer for the neighborhood. And unfortunately, it does affect them. And that's just, it sucks.
Yeah. Ultimately, we want to be a good steward to the neighborhood, and we want to be a good steward to the city. And sometimes those two things can be at odds with one another, you know, or at least their perception of that. And it's trying to walk that fine line. You know, I don't want to step on anybody's toes, but we've had people post nasty things on our Facebook and Instagram. People say nasty things to me personally, you know, threaten me. And I get it. I love where that passion and that anger is coming from. I don't consider myself the problem, but I do want to be part of the solution. And so, you know, ultimately it's listening to the needs of those people, no matter how angry they seem, and trying to figure out what's important to them and how can we work in that context to make our product better so we have less of this pushback.
Yeah, 100%. We have on the Dignuity board one guy in particular that's just been talking so much bad stuff about us since we've started our project, and it's sad. I mean, he's gotten, you know, looked over, stepped over by the HDRC, and then the board when it shifted over and everything, and he's fed up, and I completely empathize and I agree, and it's like, I'm sorry, like, there's just nothing I can do about it. Like, I've complied with everything, you know, like, and I'm trying to be a great neighbor, but at the end of the day, it's like, I don't know what to tell you. Like,
Yeah, hey, it's like politics. So you can't always change everyone's opinion.
Yeah, no shit. So wrapping up a little bit, how has this COVID crisis affected you and your business? Like, how have you noticed anything? Have you had to shift any way that you operate?
You know, I mean, we've seen at the brokerage, on the brokerage side of things, you know, we've lost a couple listings because people want to hold off on selling or they don't want people in their home. We've lost a couple listings going to leases because they didn't think they'd be able to maximize their profit on the property. You know, and then we've had agents that are doubling down working from home. And we've had agents that said, you know, that they've got to take care of their kids and stuff, and they're really retracting back. So on the brokerage side, it's been a little ebb and flow, but, you know, ultimately we'll weather this storm. I mean, we've got a good crew of agents here, a lot of people that are passionate about the city of San Antonio. And I think that helps and it takes us further and further on the brokerage side. On the renovation side, you know, or the new construction side, you know, we're booming. I'm starting to see as things are slowing down, I'm starting to pick up more property, which that means it's weeding out some of those newbies that were driving up the prices erroneously. So that's good. Another thing we did notice, we had to wait an extra week to get our lumber package on a new construction because there are still processing issues downline as a result of some of the effects of COVID. And on top of that, then you get a backlog. And so there's not enough trucks for McCoy's or Guido or whoever your lumber distributor is. So there have been, it's mostly secondary effects we're seeing, renovation side, building side, or brokerage side. It's all kind of secondary effects. So far, we've not taken any primary hits. And I'm hopeful that we'll come back to some sort of normalcy and start opening things up in the near future, obviously with restrictions. But I think if we can get things started to open back up before the end of Q4 this year, I think we'll be able to weather this storm with maybe a plateau, but no big hits. So, and that not just me personally, our general market, you know.
Is that what you're hoping for? Or is that what you think would happen?
I'm hoping and thinking that it's possible. If we don't reopen, I do feel like, again, we're going to see more of our friends' businesses close, more restaurants close. We're already suffering the big tourism tax hits. And ultimately, the burden's going to fall on all of us residents here in San Antonio. So it's figuring out ways to work with our local government and the state to start trying to reopen some of these things. Of course, with restrictions. You know, we can't do it willy-nilly or we'll close right back down. But we've got to be able to sustain something to keep people employed and move this forward so we can get past this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not. I don't like getting political at all because it just goes nowhere. But one thing that I just feel like it's been such a stupid call is that you can't shut down the government and people are not making any money, yet all the bills are still coming in with no delay. So it's like you can't take somebody's ability to earn and then tell them you still got to pay. It's like something's got to give here, you know?
No, it's tough. And imagine doing that on, you know, on a subpar income.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you and I have been fortunate to make pretty good money. And we're still feeling the effects of this a little bit. You know, I have a tenant I can't evict that hasn't paid rent in 6 months. You know, we have properties that we've lent money on that we can't foreclose on because there's no foreclosures. So, you know, it's tough. We start taking a burden here in the middle class as well. And, you know, the trickle down seems to work only for the lower classes. You know, the upper classes always, they're good. They just cream a little bit off the top and then they'll move right past, you know? So it's important, in my opinion, to try to get these places back open, you know, or have some way for them to make money.
Joshua de la Cerda says, set till 2020.
Josh is an owner of Professional Choice Remodeling. He's one of our contractors. Good people.
Good people. Thanks, Josh. Yeah, Seth's got my vote. And are you making any adjustments to your business based on this? Anticipating maybe if you know, it doesn't open up in Q4 and this continues and gets worse, like, have you thought of that? Are you making any contingencies for your business?
Yeah, we're actually, and I hate to quote Grant Cardone, I really do. But, you know, one of the things that he did when his business was in the toilet was he doubled down on his marketing.
Yes.
And we are putting in we're on the stages of putting in some good stuff together for our marketing, moving forward to try to grow the brokerage, both in agents and in total volume, network, all of that. You know, and so we're hoping over the through the end of the year to start getting all of that in place for probably, you know, soft rollout in Q4, and big rollout after January 1. And that may include bringing on, you know, somebody to help me run the brokerage. So we've been looking at that. On the investment side, you know, we're looking to pick up what we can, because I know what I'm seeing in town is well-renovated properties or well-done properties sell quickly. And if you can hit that sweet spot price point between about 230 and 300, they're not sitting on the market. People are still moving to San Antonio. So, you know, stay within those realms and you can kind of hedge your bets a little bit.
Yeah. John texted me yesterday and, like, with, you know, all the emojis and sound effects and everything you can text, saying, you know, San Antonio is under 2 months of inventory. He's like,
yeah,
properties are moving so fast and there's just no inventory that it's like, it's insane how hot the market is right now. So, all right. Well, you know, you've blown everybody's mind. You've given a ton of information. I've taken a bunch of notes. I'm going to put everything down in the show notes for everybody. Links, everything, how to get in contact with Seth. But Seth, like, what, you know, as a parting thought or anything, like, what is it that you're looking for your company? What is it that maybe, you know, what kind of business are you trying to get? Are you looking for more agents? You want investors? What are you looking for?
Yeah, right now we have no problem with clients. There's plenty of clients. In fact, like I said, we're somewhat picky, so we don't always accept the clients that come our way. I'm definitely looking to grow the agent side of things, and that's part of the process through the end of the year for us on the brokerage side. Both retail and investment, you know, we typically look for an agent that's got more than a year of experience and in that year has, you know, sold 7 to 10 properties. So I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel or train a new person necessarily. I'm trying to help someone hone in on their skills for them to truly find their niche in the real estate market and help them move their career forward, whether we're the only brokerage they ever go to or whether we're a stepping stone for them to move somewhere else. So, you know, ultimately, if anybody's got any interest in talking brokerage, let's talk. And then we're always ready to network. You know, unfortunately, it's been a little bit more difficult with the COVID stuff. You know, we used to run a monthly meetup and we're considering doing it next month. And I'm still kind of weighing the options on that. you know, relative to health concerns.
Oh, in person. You want to bring it back in person?
Yeah, we have the ability to at a place in an establishment, but it would be a double-edged sword for me in the sense that if somebody walked away and I found out later they got COVID, I know I would feel responsible.
Oh, of course.
You know, but like I said, anybody that's out there that wants to reach out, feel free to reach out. I try to respond as quickly as possible. Sometimes there's just too many calls and emails and texts and whatnot. But I really am out here to try to help and be a resource to anybody, you know, whether we're doing business directly or not.
And what's a resource, maybe a book or something that you've read that's really just, you're like, wow, how has this changed my mind and set me on such a great path? What's that?
Yeah, so I knew you were going to ask me this. So what changed my whole trajectory from the corporate world to where I am now are two different books. The first one I read is called What Should I Do With My Life by Poe Bronson. And it's a series of stories of people that have done complete career changes and their successes and failures in doing that. And it was really opening or inspiring because I realized that, like, I'm not the only one that felt this sense of anemia in the corporate workplace. There's got to be a way for me to do something else and move beyond this. And so that was great. The second book was A 4-Hour Work Week by Tim Ferriss. And I, you know, there's so many golden nuggets in there that, you know, it's if you take away one thing, it ends up changing your whole mindset. And that really prompted me to get out of the corporate world and pursue real estate full time. The last book I want to mention is the Fletch series by Gregory MacDonald. I don't read much fiction, but these books are extremely witty, full of great dialogue, and it can be a good escape from, say, all the self-help stuff that we try to read.
Yeah.
So.
No, I think that's a great recommendation. I've started getting into more fiction books just for that, just to be able to pull out of, you know, business all the time, work all the time. You need that unplug, and sometimes fiction does that for you. So, Well, sir, again, thank you so much for doing this. You've been a wealth of knowledge. I mean, and this is just like you're barely scraping the tip of permitting, zoning. I mean, this is such an involved process. And I really appreciate the work that you do in Somos Real Estate and what your company stands for. I really, you know, honor everything you do. People have nothing but great things to say about you. So thank you for being on the show and keep up the good work, sir.
Yeah, thanks for having me and cheers.
Yeah, sure, man. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, guys. So there you have it. What an amazing amount of content and information Seth delivered. Everything that he said, it goes so hand in hand with the way that we like to operate our business because it's doing things the right way, not the easy way, not the cheap way, you know, not the fast way, but the right way. And when you do things the right way, there's really only one way to do it. And you got to pull the permits. You got to make sure you're up to code. You got to make sure everything is being done correctly because this is serious. So this is a house, all right? Like, this is not a computer that you're buying. This is a house. People are going to live there. They're going to bring their families there. You need to have some conscience in you to think about that, to think about what's coming and what's going to happen with that next owner. And you want to give them something that's safe and something that they can live in there for years and no problems are going to happen. So rewatch this again. If you're listening to this on the podcast, on the descriptions below, I'm going to put all the links that we talked about, how to get a hold of Seth. He's on Facebook, Instagram, Somos Real Estate. Check him out. Great content, great information all the time from them. They're killing it in this market. So reach out to them. And if you're an agent and you have at least a year of experience, reach out to Seth and Somos. Definitely a great brokerage to go work for. So thank you all for watching, and I will catch you guys on the next episode.